Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each episode, we pick a recently published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. So I really have no idea where my electricity comes from. I've powered up my computer, plugged in the mic, and hit record, and I know at some level that I've made myself part of an electrical grid that I'm channeling into my home, into the wall socket, up into my computer, electricity generated somewhere else. But I have no idea where that somewhere else is. I mean, I can step outside and trace the power lines emerging from my house down the street, and then they turn a corner, and I can't see that far. My guest today has made those power lines historically visible for one region of North America. In the middle decades of the 20th century, small settler towns in the deserts of the Southwest began booming into major metropolitan hubs. In 1940, Phoenix had a population of only 65,000 and an economy based largely on agriculture. 40 years later, it was a city of skyscraper tombs, in the words of Edward Abbey, with 1.5 million people. And these people demanded power. Power for factories, for air conditioners, for televisions and refrigerators. For Phoenix and other southwestern cities, that somewhere else from which electricity was channeled was the Navajo Nation, the largest reservation in the United States, and by 1980, home to two of the largest strip mines in the world. With their traditional economy targeted for disruption by mid-century federal policies, some Navajo leaders welcomed resource extraction and coal-burning plants to alleviate poverty. But exploitative energy contracts and devastating ecological impacts only fostered inequality. By the 1960s and 1970s, a new generation of Navajo activists rose up to challenge their colonial relationship to the urban centers of the modern Southwest, a once fragmented region stitched together by the infrastructure of energy. Andrew Needham, associate professor of history at New York University, tells this story with eloquence and force in Power Lines, Phoenix and the Making of the Modern Southwest, from Princeton University Press. I began by asking him how he came to write this book.
I started this project actually long, at least mentally, long before I started graduate school. I'm not from the Southwest. I'm not from Phoenix. But I was on a family vacation when I was in either late high school or early college. And we were going camping in the San Juan Mountains. My family and I had flown from Wisconsin, where we lived, into Albuquerque. And we're driving up through western New Mexico to southwestern Colorado. And I saw a kind of plume of smoke on the horizon. And I initially thought, we're driving through this kind of high, desert kind of red rock landscape of the eastern stretch of the Colorado Plateau. And I saw this plume of smoke on the horizon. And I initially thought it was a forest fire. And I was kind of excited by that idea that I would get to see the planes dropping fire retardant and all of that, all these things that I'd seen on the news. And then I came over a crest that sits above the valley that Four Corners Power Plant sits down in, and saw the stacks, the four stacks of Four Corners Power Plant, and had a real moment of outrage, of kind of, well, what is this doing here? I'm out here going to see nature, and I'm going to have this, experience of difference. And here's this factory. Like, how can this factory be here? And so, and then, of course, at that night, we stayed in a hotel where I unknowingly, almost certainly, used the power that had been generated there. And that, that experience of, what is this doing here, kind of had stayed with me a long time. And as I was in graduate school, thinking about the kind of work that I wanted to do, and I began really as an environmental historian and a Western historian, I kept coming back to Four Corners as a site of incongruity, and that didn't that question you know, why is this power plant located in this landscape, didn't make sense to me in terms of the stories that historians had told about urban development. It didn't make sense to me in the stories that historians had told about the place of Indian peoples in kind of post-World War II life. And so I started to investigate. I started following the power lines away from Four Corners and found that this was a power plant built by a company named Arizona Public Service, which was the largest private utility in the state of Arizona, that it was centered in Phoenix, that the power lines, you know, in many ways led back to Phoenix. And that really, that was really the kind of, when I found out that the power lines from Four Corners led to Phoenix, and that these two, you know, seemingly very different landscapes, and different in the way that we think of them in terms of modernity, one being a kind of modern sprawling metropolis, the other being, the kind of landscape of John Ford, that these were actually intimately tied together in the process of generating the power that that fuels modern life. That was really the kind of takeoff point for my story, and led me to start to kind of question all kinds of things about what do we mean when we say modern? Where do native peoples fit into these stories of modernity? Why haven't we thought about how native resources function in the metropolitan economy, in a cohesive and systematic way? Those were the kinds of questions that really almost jumped out at me the minute I started to kind of think, you know, deeply about this power plant.
So one of the most, I think, innovative and important contributions of this work, which you are kind of alluding to here, is the different scholarly fields that you're integrating, you're putting into conversation. So I want to identify a couple of those threads and see how you weave them together, especially for people who listen to this podcast who may not be familiar with them. So I want to begin with studies of U.S. cities in the 20th century. What have you learned from this sort of this very important historiography, but what are you also challenging in it in this book?
The story that historians have told for the past 20 years about American cities is a story of the way capitalism has unevenly developed space. And kind of central to that story has been a story about the construction of what Robert Self calls the white noose that surrounds increasingly non-white inner cities. So it's a story of kind of the disinvestment in inner cities that helps to produce suburban America. And that, you know, that narrative to me, this kind of narrative of a white noose that surrounds cities, and that kind of explaining inequality was central to urban history. It was deeply influential on me. At the same time, in telling this story of a kind of white suburban America and increasingly non-white inner city America, what got left out of that story was the experience of peoples that live in other landscapes. Cities exist not only as kind of these discrete spaces, but as part of sprawling networks that reach deep into the countryside for water, for power, for waste disposal. Kind of what environmental studies scholars would call negative externalities of urban life. And so is thinking about how do kind of the Navajo people of the Southwest fit into these stories of metropolitan inequality allowed me really to challenge that map that urban historians have drawn of, you know, kind of inequality in metropolitan space, and to think about the way that metropolitan development, the growth of these, of a place like Phoenix, which grows from 40,000 people in 1940 or 65,000 people in 1940 over 3 million, in the present day, creates these kind of far reaching systems of exploitation and expropriation, that it relies on it, that those people rely on, in Phoenix to live their lives. So kind of redrawing the map of inequality in metropolitan America is certainly to include Native peoples and to say that kind of the underdevelopment of the Navajo reservation and the Navajo Nation is central to what Phoenix becomes. Perhaps the largest project of the book itself.
Mm. So, Native American studies or Native American history has rarely, though maybe increasingly, there are a few instances, and I think there will be a few more in the coming years, turned its attention to urban space in the 20th century. But this isn't exactly a history of Native peoples in cities, which we're starting to see, or even a history about cities built on Native land, though of course Phoenix is, but rather a city, as you say, that grew through the extraction of resources and ultimately the underdevelopment of the Navajo Nation. So what do you think this work has to offer, and what has it learned from Native American and indigenous studies? And do you see yourself as working within that field?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I very much do see myself working in that field. And what that field has taught me in reading the kind of variety of great books that have come out in the time that I've been working on this book is the kind of the flexibility of the political strategies of Native people in pursuing power in oftentimes very dire circumstances in a nation that oftentimes allows structurally conceives of kind of Native people as without power, and so this is my book's if you had to kind of put it into what kind of history this is predominantly political history. But what I found in looking at the variety of strategies that Navajo people used is that you see a really broad range of stories that Navajo leaders, kind of Navajo youth activists, everyday people living, on these landscapes tell about what energy development is doing to their landscapes and what the possibility of it is. I mean, there's, a number of, Navajo leaders in the 50s and 60s who really imagine energy development as enabling the Navajo Nation to realize the same kind of economic growth that Phoenix has realized. They're going to use, they imagine using the power from these plants to, in effect, build a high-tech economy on the Navajo Nation. And as that, as those possibilities, and as those promises increasingly seem, empty to lots and lots of people, on the Navajo Nation, people turn to different strategies. People turn to what I see as an anti-colonial critique that very much kind of locates these plants as not part of a story of the kind of mutual growth of a region, which is the previous story that was being told, and the story being very much told by Arizona's political leaders, and being a story of colonization that demands a decolonial response. Has a variety of differences, from a strategy of of kind of demanding the nationalization of coal mines and power plants by leaders, to a demand that to a belief that that energy development and Navajo culture more broadly are just incompatible.
Mm-hmm. Let's dive into the narrative a little
and
bit.
And conceiving that not sure.
Just to sort of step back and get us to that point. When Navajo people start articulating these various political strategies, which you're beginning to introduce here. But I want to set up the story a little bit. And one of the things I love about environmental history is that, you know, I think I'm reading a book about the 20th century U.S. and all of a sudden on page 27, there are dinosaurs, you know.
One of my friends has said I'm the only urban historian to work the word triceratops into his book, which I'm quite proud of.
Yeah. So you know, I do want to, you know, I ostensibly want to start in the early 20th century, but before that, I mean, what are the elements of the geological backstory of the Southwest that are important and that bear upon the 20th century story?
Well, I'd long there's the kind of almost a trope. An environmental history of, you know, the book, you begin your book, you know, when the earth was young and, mm-hmm. and all these things. And I avoided that for a long time. And then I really came to think that it's important to understand, you know, the processes that, that determine why coal is located in particular places and not in others. And these, you know, this becomes deeply kind of important, in the book. And do also to explain the kind of processes that end up shaping the landscape itself. And so, you know, that story reaches back, you know, 100 million years ago when the Cretaceous sea, you know, there was basically a giant kind of sea that spanned the inner continent of North America. And it's, you know, the kind of swamplands along that sea that give rise to the coal beds of today. And so I kind of began, you know, with that story just to, you know, in part to say that this is going to be a story about kind of exploitation and inequality between people. But this is also a story about the kind of exploitation of a resource that exists because of, you know, not because of human action, but because of kind of long natural processes that people have had, you know, nothing to do with, and that they will kind of exploit at a particular point in time for a particular set of reasons. Hmm.
So you call the Southwest in the early 20th century a region of fragments. What do you mean?
I think there's a way in which oftentimes historians take region for granted, and that regions exist as connected places, you know, as a kind of matter of as a matter of being. And one of the stories that I really wanted to tell in this book is how connections between, you know, Phoenix and the Navajo Nation, and then the rest of, you know, several other cities in the Southwest came to be and came to forge connections that didn't exist before. So kind of starting early in the, you know, in the 20th century, I really see the kind of that, you know, parts of what will become the region I call the modern Southwest as existing with little, you know, little connection to each other. So the Navajo spaces of kind of northern Arizona have little connection to, you know, to Phoenix, which exists as a kind of, you know, small agricultural city in central Arizona. They're very different spaces ecologically. There's very little kind of, you know, human connection between, you know, between those different places. And it's the kind of, it's the construction of a network of power lines that comes to, you know, forge a regional a sense that these places are both. It forges both actual material connections, right, between, you know, Phoenix and the Navajo Nation, but also an understanding by people in both places that these, you know, that, you know, that these two places, you know, are increasingly part of the same region. And that, you know, those connections will eventually span, come to span not only Phoenix and the Navajo Nation, but will, you know, will connect to other cities in the Southwest. Because one of the stories I tell is how, you know, an initial connection between, you know, Phoenix and energy resources on the Navajo Nation, you know, comes to be a kind of, you know, grid of power lines that connects the Navajo Nation not only to Phoenix, but also to Albuquerque, Los Angeles, Salt Lake City, Denver, to a point where the Navajo Nation really becomes the center of this new region that, you know, ends up providing a large amount of the electrical power that will fuel its development.
So one of the central kind of actors, if you can call it that, in this story is the federal government. It's changing, but its vital role in stitching this region together and then fostering a certain kind of unequal and damaging form of urban growth. You know, one of the places where we see that extension of federal power most viscerally, at least in the early part of this book, is the stock reduction of Navajo animals in the 1930s, which, you know, just kind of stuck out for me because it casts a much darker light, I think, on the sometimes celebrated head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, John Collier. But I was also, you know, reading about this, you know, as you put it, this destruction of what they called sheep units among the Navajo, this sort of relationship that they had with animals that was part of their, you know, culture and way of life and mode of production. And I couldn't help but think about this as a process of enclosure, almost a kind of violent, originary or primitive accumulation that needs to occur in order to create a capitalist market. I mean, the relationship between Navajos and their animals is not one that that is conducive to the introduction of capitalism. So you kind of destroy their means of subsistence. Is that a fair understanding of what's going on, maybe, with stock reduction, or how does this kind of stock reduction fit into the story of stitching the region together?
No, that's a great question. And I have to start this answer by just giving a shout out to both you know, historians like Marshall Weisiger, who I drew on extensively, and then also a kind of, you know, a large number of Navajo scholars, Jennifer Dennett-Dale, and a lot of others who have done really marvelous work kind of excavating the back history of this story. And, you know, I think that, you know, what they've shown and what I drew upon is that the process of stock reduction served to destroy, I think, a means of subsistence that was already in the kind of 1920s shaky because of a variety of ecological changes, but had allowed Navajo people to retain a kind of flexible strategy for survival in a market economy. That kind of life, I think, for New Deal leaders seemed archaic to them. And I think that, you know, one of the, if we think about, you know, what Collier's doing in his policies, he really has a kind of, you know, for, you know, I mean, Collier has his definite merits, right? I mean, kind of, and you know, the kind of policies of ending allotment, ending the Dawes Act, ending the kind of crippling, the kind of the cultural, you know, violence of the boarding schools. I, you know, all of that is, you know, is to his credit. At the same time, I think Collier is willing to is very hesitant to kind of listen to Native people and attempt to kind of make conversation a two-way street when he's kind of proposing stock reduction policies, to Navajo audiences. He speaks in English. He doesn't kind of allow time for his remarks to be translated into Navajo. He's not particularly concerned. He does not seem particularly concerned with, you know, making sure that these are that he's understood or that he understands what, you know, what Navajo concerns are. And, you know, I think he really sees what's required is a project of rationalization, rationalization of environments, rationalization of land use. In his mind, this is what will, you know, save the Navajo in the modern world. In practice, his policies end up, you know, being the final thing that I think, you know, fractures this subsistence strategy that had, you know, allowed Navajos to have until that point, a quite successful response to conquest.
So Phoenix in 1940, small, sort of oasis city, Phoenix in 1960 looks like a very different place, and very different place. So some of the actors you kind of trace in this are these crop of business leaders in Phoenix that represent kind of new industries. They're not the old white wealth of Arizona. I mean, if you can even call it old, but represent
old's a relative term.
Old's a relative term. A few decades older, but. But I want to talk a bit about these boosters and not just what they were up to, but also if you could talk a bit about the imagery of Native people in the region that they deployed to sort of sell the region to attract investment, to attract, you know, settlers, essentially, to attract certain federal policies. And if I can just add one more element to that question, it's so interesting to see the frequent reappearance of Barry Goldwater in this text. Because, you know, here's this founding father of the new right that's often written about in these histories of the rise of modern conservatism. But, you know, I had no idea he had so much to say about Indian people, you know, and the role of federal Indian policy, which, I don't think you get out of some of the texts. So big question, you know, what are these business people up to in the middle decades of the 20th century that help propel, you know, Phoenix to this vastly different place?
No, that's a great question. And I think that, you know, one of the what they see is a couple of things. One of the things they see is capital that's increasingly mobile in a couple ways. One way is that, you know, factories have, since the early 20th century, really kind of begun to open a series of kind of subsidiaries and branch plants. And so making their city attractive to that kind of industrial capital, which means kind of legal changes, laws that prevent unionization, that cut taxes on businesses, that cut down on regulation, kind of what we think of as the kind of economic policies of modern conservatism, work as a local industrial development strategy. And I think that that's really one of the places those sets of ideas emerge from. The other way that they see capital being mobile is in people, as in white, you know, particularly white suburbanites who, because of policies that the federal government enacts in the during the New Deal and afterward, are increasingly able to take on debt and to take on mortgage debt, other kinds of debt, you know, whether it's consumer credit at Barry Goldwater's department store to buy, a new washer dryer. In a way, these kind of white people who, as Ira Katznelson has described, this era of the, kind of New Deal up until, the 1960s is a moment when affirmative action was white, when the federal government is making, is giving preferential treatment in terms of the way that they will guarantee white people credit, over non-white people. Those people, because they can, have mortgage debt that's federally underwritten, that's federally insured, become really attractive. And ironically, kind of the presence of Native Americans becomes a kind of cultural way to differentiate how life in Phoenix is different than life they might find elsewhere in the, elsewhere in the country. And what makes Phoenix different is you can have all the, all the pleasures of modern, modern life. You can have, outdoor recreation. You can, you can have a warm climate. You can avoid snow. But you can also escape from Phoenix very easily and experience a different way of life on Indian in nature and on Indian land. There's a terrific quote that one of the things that these boosters do is kind of invite a bunch of reporters out to kind of profile Phoenix in the 50s and 60s. They usually invite them out in February. There's no accident. In one of these stories, an executive, who's profiled says, I used to commute from Oyster Bay every day, an hour and a half each way. Oyster Bay is a suburb of New York on Long Island. Now I live on the desert just beyond town. I can go home at lunchtime and take a dip in my pool. After work or on weekends, I play tennis and golf. Sometimes I go prospecting for uranium in the Superstition Mountains with an Indian friend of mine. I just enjoy life about 10 times as much.
the Indian friend of mine. That's so perfect.
The Indian friend, right, kind of gets embedded into this story as a way to experience difference, right? And it's oftentimes, oftentimes kind of trips out into the Indian spaces of Arizona are really characterized as trips back in time, and saying that you can live a modern life and then drive, 100 miles north, and you can be, you can experience time as it was, 100 years ago.
The racialization that happens there too with my Indian friend. I mean, you would never have that person writing back and saying, I moved to Phoenix and, I have a black friend, from the
right.
So they would never say in 1950s.
Right. I mean, that's one of the fascinating things, right? Is the way that kind of race in the Southwest becomes a strategy of, development. Whereas in the South, right, all these cities like Atlanta are saying that. I mean, Atlanta's calling itself the city too busy to hate.
Right. Right.
Right.
Which is like, saying,
I think that the way that, kind of Indian people in this don't figure as people, right? They figure as iconic ideas of difference.
But of course, if we go out to the Navajo Nation, in this period, there are some real changes happening. In the growth of Phoenix means certain infrastructure projects on the Navajo Nation in this period. Did Navajo leaders, as the city is growing and as it demands more and more energy and city leaders and state leaders start to look to the Navajo Nation to provide that energy, what was the response of the Navajo leadership in this period, in the 50s and the early 60s? Did they encourage this kind of development? And if so, what strings attached?
So I think the important context here, I think the deeply important context for this moment is the federal policy of termination. You know, and I think termination is experienced by Indian leaders in a much more kind of Indian political leaders in a much more kind of visceral, as a much more visceral danger than we've appreciated. I mean, I think that that Indian political leaders across the country are really imagining an incipient kind of end to two federal protections and two treaty protections. And so they are, very much kind of looking for strategies to, create development that can, protect their people from this moment. At the same time this is going on, political leaders in Phoenix and Arizona are very much courting, Indians around the state, saying work with us, open your lands to development. This is the route to solving your problems of underdevelopment. Bring your resources into the market, and this is. There are conferences held where, Indian, elected officials are brought, go to Phoenix, meet with business executives, tour farms and power plants, and are kind of told all this can be yours if you kind of work and ally with us against the federal government. Of course, there's a long existing strategy and idea here that held by the state leaders that the federal lands in their state are unjustly controlled by the federal government. And so this is, I think, we can think of kind of Indian officials and Indian leaders really caught, but existing between these two kind of poles. And really, kind of looking for strategies to create new means of economic support. At this moment in the 19, really kind of, I think we could locate it from the late 40s, up into the late 60s.
So by the 1960s, the Navajo Nation, the Hopi Nations, you write, become the sort of broad point of origin for most of the electricity used by consumers in the Southwest. As you say, you flip on a light switch in your downtown Phoenix apartment, and you link yourself unknowingly to the Navajo Nation and an infrastructure project there. I mean, in theory, this should make Navajo people very wealthy. But as we know, in all sorts of places around the world where people without forms of institutional power that have natural resources under their land don't actually benefit from them, unless they are able to nationalize, in a sense, or perhaps as one of the paths that one could take. And in the 1960s and in the 1970s, you write about this new crop of Navajo leaders that begin to challenge the energy policies of an earlier generation, the way the contracts were written, and the relationship that's developed. Can you talk a bit about that movement in the 60s and 70s, what it looks like?
Maybe talk a bit about
Peter MacDonald.
Yeah. Sure. No, and I think it's really important to realize just how exploitative these, contracts that are signed in the 1960s are. Navajo Mine, which is the kind of the mine that feeds Four Corners Power Plant, pays the tribe a royalty of 15 cents per ton of coal used on the reservation. The Four Corners plant is on the reservation, or 20 cents for it used off the reservation. Arizona Public Service, the utility that then buys the coal from the mining company, Utah International, that runs and owns the lease for Navajo Mine, is paid $3 a ton. You see a kind of really dramatic, difference from kind of what you know, who is getting the returns from this, you know, from this development. At Black Mesa and Kayenta mines, which are located, you know, near the junction of the Navajo and Hopi reservations, the royalties there are 20 and 25 cents per ton. And those are royalties that remain fixed for a long, long time. So by the 1970s, when these kind of both when these returns look relatively paltry, and when the environmental damages associated with coal mining and electrical power generation are becoming plainly evident to people who live near the plants, this, you know, really kind of, you know, creates a, you know, a kind of broad scale sense, I think, you know, among Navajos that these have been, and, you know, that leaders had entered into really exploitative arrangements. And so this is kind of where, you know, Peter MacDonald, who's elected tribal chairman in 1970, comes in. Peter MacDonald, you know, runs on, you know, on a platform of saying not that I will end energy development on Navajo land, but that Navajos deserve what he calls a piece of the action, and that, you know, Navajos really deserve a much larger share of both the profits generated from these plants, but also in the management of these plants. And, you know, he's really envisioning these plants as a new, if in an earlier conception, electrical power generation was supposed to draw kind of new industry to the reservation and kind of new jobs. For MacDonald, the plants can serve as a means to kind of help train a new generation of Navajo managers that can one day take them over. And so he's really demanding a kind of greater voice in the management of plants, in kind of that, you know, Navajo people should not only work in the lowest rungs of employment at the plants, but they should also be able to go and work in St. Louis at Peabody Coal's headquarters there. And they should be managers. You know, so he's, you know, really seeking to pursue kind of pursue arrangements where the Navajo Nation would have joint ownership of, you know, of both coal mines and power plants. You know, at the same time that he's, you know, proposing, and this, you know, he's really proposing a kind of decolonial strategy of nationalization. At the same time that he's, you know, proposing this, there are other people saying that there are no ways that that the system itself is so unequal and exploitative that that the strategy should be rejection, and, you know, and kind of rejecting the presence of energy development itself on you know, on Navajo land, and removing the plants rather than nationalizing.
And so how do, you know, this is a big question, but what happens? I mean, is Peter MacDonald successful? I mean, are, you know, if you can take this story through the present.
Sure. No, and I think that you know, one thing that kind of one dynamic that I really discovered in doing this is the power of capital, the power of investment, once it's set in place on the landscape. In the early 70s, MacDonald and the Navajo Nation enter into negotiations with a company called Wesco. And this is the kind of height of the oil crisis and the energy crises of the early 1970s, and Wesco wants to open a series of what are called coal gasification plants, which would transform coal into methane, and essentially transform coal, you know, into natural gas, and even in some cases into gasoline, as a, you know, as a means of, you know, kind of supplanting oil, global oil supplies. WESCO, you know, offers up in a way the kind of arrangement that McDonald is looking for. It's not a kind of joint ownership. It's not a 50-50 share, but the royalties are much better. There's an enforceable Navajo employment clause both at the plant and in, you know, in a training program at WESCO's corporate headquarters. And, you know, they are, you know, I think they're, you know, qualitatively better contracts than is offered that were offered at, you know, Four Corners or Black Mesa. At the same time, local opposition is, you know, incredibly, you know, incredibly unanimous against the plant at the local chapter called Burnham. There are three votes taken, I think, out of three votes, probably out of 1,000 total votes, the number of votes in favor of the plants may be in the single digits at the local chapter level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this local opposition and the, you know, people from the Navajo tribe, officials from the Navajo tribe are saying things like, you know, the people at Black Mesa have sacrificed for the Navajo Nation. The people at Four Corners have sacrificed for the Navajo Nation. Now it's Burnham's turn, essentially, to sacrifice. Mm. And, you know, that's not quite an accurate representation of, I think, how the people at Black Mesa, you know, had felt about, you know, or at, you know, at, you know, near Navajo line had felt about these, you know, about, you know, their, you know, their sacrifice was not, you know, particularly willing choice. That kind of rejection before the investment, before the capital gets located in space in the form of, you know, in the form of a power plant, in the form of a power line, is, you know, malleable. These plants are defeated. You know, in part because it's too difficult for the company to locate, you know, the plants there politically. At the same time, Four Corners power plant, Navajo generating station, Navajo mine, Black Mesa and Kayenta mines, have been, you know, our capital invested, in place, and, you know, until the mid 2000s, you know, really continued, you know, resisted, you know, efforts to, you know, to close them, resisted, you know, efforts to even at Four Corners install technologies that would reduce emissions from the, you know, from the plants. I mean, this is, you know, in a way, this is the kind of the early history of the battle over coal-fired power plants that we see today, working itself out nationally, is first kind of pursued and articulated by Navajo people. I mean, you know, yeah, kind of Navajo people have been debating coal-fired power a lot longer than, you know, than the rest of Americans, you know, have been. And I think there are, you know, that, you know, they know a lot more about, you know, the problems of coal-fired power, that other Americans are just beginning to discover.
I do want to push you on maybe one contention within that, and I'm undecided on it myself. And I think that, you know,
I probably am too.
So this idea that once capital is fixed in place, as you say, once the physical energy production infrastructure is there, meaningful challenges to the system become, you know, if not impossible, then very, very difficult. And certainly the story you've told illustrates that well. And I think there's actually lessons in that probably for the resistance efforts, predominantly among First Nations in Canada, but also in the U.S. around the sort of pipeline projects and the extraction projects that, I mean, essentially you better stop them before they even go into the ground, because once they go into the ground. But I guess what I'm wondering is, I just, whenever I hear something, you know, so you say at the end of the book, once capital is fixed in space, it really could not be reversed. It could only be regulated. And I just, is there no alternative past a certain point, in essence? Are we trapped once the infrastructure gets put in place?
I think that's probably too categorical.
Okay.
I mean, I think that it could not be reversed. It could only be regulated. I think what does happen is that kind of capital fixed in place changes the terms. It makes resistance much more difficult, and requires strategies that would target kind of different. I'm trying to think of a way that, like, you know, so many of the power plants in the Southwest are today being shut down. Mojave Generating Station, which was fed by a coal slurry line from Black Mesa, a pipeline that stretched 300 miles from Black Mesa to the Colorado River, where a deep aquifer was mined to mix with coal dust to transport this coal. A deep aquifer, of course, in the landscape that receives 8 inches of rain a year. This plant was shut down because of concerns about kind of climate change emissions. It was shut down in 2007. That's certainly an example of where kind of capital fixed in place, ceased to function, where these kind of infrastructure, more or less abandoned. The reason that it was abandoned, though, had to do with kind of state regulation and federal regulation rather than local activism. So I think that maybe what that says is that once capital is fixed in place, kind of how it functions, requires a different kind of politics, and a politics at a different location, and requires new forms of political alliance building, where the strategy against the Burnham plants was largely locally driven. The strategy to close Mojave Generating Station was a strategy pursued at the state of California and the federal level. And that requires a different kind of Navajo people were involved and engaged, in those debates. And they were involved in seeing that there were some, in a sense, compensation paid for, the years that Mojave Generating Station had operated the way that the coal mine, had provided good jobs, and that the kind of reduction in production with the closing of Mojave would be compensated. But it was also a strategy that had to, that required a really broad alliance. Hmm.
So I've been speaking with Andrew Needham, who's associate professor of history at New York University. We've been discussing Power Lines, Phoenix, and the Making of the Modern Southwest. It came out from the university, the Princeton University Press last year. By way of getting to a conclusion, I guess I want to ask if there's one thing you hope readers can come away from this book with. And I know that they're, readers are differently located. You maybe want a different, the takeaway you desire might be different depending on who's reading it and where they're reading it. We're both talking in the Northeast. Our power, the electricity that is generating this conversation over Skype is not being drawn from the Navajo Nation. So
Hydro-Quebec.
Is that right?
Some of it.
See, that's already such a fascinating... I mean, this is one of the things I just love this project is you've taken something that is... And this is what great history should do. You've taken something that is unquestioned and naturalized and say, you know, where does this come from? You know, I don't know the energy source of the electricity I'm using right now. Though this book will motivate me to find out. And I'll take your word for it. It's Hydro-Quebec for New York and New England.
That's one of the... sources. That's a kind of, that's, you know, I mean, one of the things that happens to electricity is that kind of where it comes from becomes increasingly difficult to trace, right?
Right,
as kind of
right.
multiple sources are, you know, collected into pools that consumers, you know, draw on because of the way that kind of, you know, engineers turn, you know, bring plants online and take them offline and channel power in different directions. But I mean, I think that, you know, you have targeted, you know, one of the things that I really hope that, you know, ways that I hope people use my book is that just to kind of, you know, to do their own kind of acts of, you know, of tracing power. You know, and I think, you know, in a surprising, I mean, you know, this book is, you know, very much about the Southwest. But I think, you know, in a surprising number of cases, tracing these power lines are going to lead people back to spaces where Native peoples live today, and are going to reveal kind of stories of, you know, of dispossession that, you know, oftentimes remain hidden. I mean, the most valuable responses I've gotten to this point of the book are some emails that I've received from Navajo people saying that, you know, this is, you know, people who worked at the power plants and said, you know, kind of what you've written is really, you know, is really important, and you know, reflects what I remember accurately, and you know, that's, you know, to see that was incredibly, you know, incredibly heartening.
Sure.
And you know, I think that you're right, is that kind of people in different places will read and can hopefully use this book in different ways. But I think that that act of tracing power and thinking about the kind of material details of, you know, one's daily lives and, you know, who they touch and what inequalities are embedded in them is a useful exercise for people attempting to live morally in the world.
Professor Needham, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Andrew Needham, author of Power Lines, Phoenix and the Making of the Modern Southwest from Princeton University Press. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all of the past podcasts. We're also on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening.